What have we learned about the tasks before John Thune in the first 100 days of President Trump? From SDPB, today is Wednesday, April 16th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, the Dakota Political Junkies offer analysis on Leader Thune's role in maintaining the relevance of Congress. A recent New Yorker article offers a Washington insider's look at the role of the Republican majority leader. We offer a home state perspective. Where do 500,000 immigrants with legal status go when that status is revoked? We'll talk about challenges facing Haitians in America and the nonprofit organizations designed to help. Plus, how to spot a deepfake before you end up in a conference call with a bot. That's coming later in the hour. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. In her capacity as head of the Department of Homeland Security, Kristi Noem made an announcement last month. More than 500,000 people with work visas would lose their temporary parole status on April 24th. Noem announced the end of a Biden-era humanitarian immigration policy. It offered temporary work visas to some Cubans, Haitians, Nicaraguans, Venezuelans, and Ukrainians. Now, as of Monday, a federal judge has blocked that move, but it got us thinking, where can these immigrants go if it's too dangerous to return to their home country? Bruce Bloomer is co-founder of the Haiti Alive nonprofit. He joined me in SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. We'll start with an update from Haiti Alive.
We have a ministry in Haiti. It's on an island called Laganov. It's a 40 by 10 mile island. That's about 50 miles northwest of Port-au-Prince. And the blessing, if you know what's going on in Haiti, the blessing is it's hard to get to that island. There's no gang activity there. We're able to continue our ministry there. It's going well. We have a school with 250 kids in there. We have a couple clinics. We're actually adding an addition onto one of our clinics right now. We're building the last 7 homes of our women's village, and so that will be full with 64 homes, and we're really excited. That's just become a really neat project and a really neat community. And so we do some feeding programs, we do some other things, but it became an official nonprofit in 2013, so just a little over 11 years. We've started very small. I was in Haiti during the earthquake, and I just had this deep conviction that we needed to do something. And it started small. It started with our church in Mitchell, and we just started with a handful of school scholarships, and we tried to help this doctor go to medical school. We just sent money for food. We just did things small, and it just grew.
Are you able to go back and forth now?
No. There's actually, flights aren't even allowed by the FAA into Haiti. After the gang violence has increased so much, you can't even fly into Port-au-Prince right now. There are no flights in there. And about 85% of Port-au-Prince is now under gang control. And so it's really a difficult, difficult situation. There is a city on the north part of Haiti called Cap Haitien. There is some people still getting through there, but it's very, very limited to in and out.
So your organization has also hired a new executive director. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, I'm really excited about that. Our board has been talking for a couple of years that this ministry has really been my baby, and so it's kind of grown. So if I go away, what happens to the ministry? So we've had some good conversations about we needed to do something. Kristi Jones and I worked on a nonprofit committee together. She actually came to Haiti with us in 2020. She actually took over for an organization. She did like a 6-month interim CEO of that organization for 6 months. She's an attorney here in Sioux Falls. She and I just became friends, and we met for coffee every once in a while. And I just woke up one night and I said, literally woke up in bed and I said, Kristi Jones, she's the right person. And I called her the next day and I said, you don't know this, but you're going to be the next director of Haiti Alive. And she goes, can we talk about this? And I said, nope, it's already got ordained. you're in. And so we met several times. And so she's a part-time director. Okay. I'm still going to be involved with the ministry. I'm still going to work with donors and do receipt letters, some of those detail things. But I'm going to hand off just the fundraising, the social media, all that public recognition part. I had some pretty significant health issues this year, and so that kind of accelerated my desire to get somebody on board. And so she's still part-time. She's going to continue as an attorney here in Sioux Falls. But this is her ministry thing, the thing that she cares about for us, and she's going to be great. It's just going to be a new perspective, just a new face for the organization, and I'm just super excited about her getting started.
All right, so let's talk about some of the challenges. Right now, we are hearing about from Washington, people are getting notified that their status might be revoked or there's a deadline for this. Help us explain what this program is first, and then we'll talk about how it's changing
right
here this month.
So the program is called the I-134A program, and President Biden identified five countries that were really significant, countries with significant issues: Haiti, Cuba, Venezuela, Nicaragua, and the Ukraine. And so those countries are some very, deep difficulties in those countries. And so the people from those countries could apply to come to the United States. So they went through our immigration office. They had to apply. They actually had the added step of they had to have a sponsor. And so the sponsor had to say, I vouch for this person. I'm also willing to provide some financial support. They have to actually put in like their tax returns of how much assets they have. And then they were given a work visa. And so they're coming to the United States and they are working. And frankly, they're doing some jobs that not a lot of people here want to do. It's really disturbing to me that that the president revoked this I-134A program. They don't really know what their status is. They were the people were identified that said as of April 24th, their status is in jeopardy. People don't really know what that means. And the part that I find the most disturbing is the president and, our former governor have said you have to come here legally. Well, they did. They went through our immigration office. They applied to come here. They've completed all those forms. They had to have the additional step of having a sponsor here who said, I vouch for this person. I will provide some financial support if they need it. And they got a work visa. So they're here. They're paying taxes. They're doing exactly what they have said that they want people to do who are coming to the United States, and now they're saying that their immigration status is in jeopardy.
And you just said there's no flights going back to Haiti. So if their status is revoked and they're not here with legal status, they could be, in theory, removed, but they cannot self-deport to Haiti because they can't get there. Do I understand this correctly?
And I can't speak to the other four countries, but I know about Haiti. Mm-hmm. The FAA said there are no flights going into Haiti till at least the fall. So you can't fly into the country. The other part of that is Port-au-Prince is a mess. About 85% of Port-au-Prince is now under gang control. And so if you're flying these people, if you could fly them back, and maybe they can do military, I don't know, but if they would deport these people, you're giving them a death sentence or at least a very significant, difficult life when 85% of the biggest city and the capital city is controlled by gangs. And so it's just unconscionable to me that you would consider sending people back to a country that has that level of difficulty.
So there were some challenges with the program. It was paused during the Biden administration because there were concerns about fraud, especially trafficking, that people would sponsor too many people to come and work for them. And then it was reinstated after investigations went through. Do we have any idea how many people in South Dakota, how many people in this region are impacted or had that I-134A participation?
Right. I don't know, honestly. I know that there are over 500,000 people who came here under that program. So I don't know how many are in Sioux Falls, how many are in South Dakota regionally. I don't have that number. But I do know that 500,000 people is a significant number of people. Yes, it was paused for a period of time, but it also then it was reinstated, and those people again had to go through the process, and they had to, fill out the forms and so forth. And so, I don't know the number, but I do know that those people are here legally. They're here on work visas, and they don't really know, and they can't find out any answers about what the next steps are. And like you said, they can't self-deport to Haiti because there's no way physically to get to Haiti.
Yeah, and if they arrive, their lives are at risk.
They're definitely at risk. The gangs are already geared up. They're already saying if they come back, they're gonna be at the airport. I mean, they've already made that known. The interesting tactic that they do, they're controlling the radio. And so they will say, we're going to be in this village 2 days from now or in this, and we're going to take over this village. And they go there and they hurt people, kill people, take over the village. They're broadcasting where they're going, and there's no one to stop them. There's no police force. If people come back from the United States or other places, they're going to be at the airport waiting for them, and they're going to constrict into their gang.
I mean, it will force them to join. Yeah,
exactly. Mm-hmm. So it's just a really difficult situation.
What do you want? Do you think? Well, that's speculative to say. Do you think they understand how the program worked and they just want it to go away? Like, what do you think is happening? Is this caught up in a broader? Hey, this 500,000 people, if we get rid of 500,000 people, we can say we reduce the number of people who were in America by this much. Or is it a technical glitch that will get cleared up? I don't need you to speculate.
The thing that I have said, the people that have asked me, is that I think it will get hung up in courts. I think this is illegal. I think there will be people that will say this is not a good process, you know, that to end their status without any kind of, you know, warning or any way to get back. I think it'll end up in the courts. And so I'm hoping that will pause any kind of deportation. I know that the president made some very derogatory and frankly untrue statements about Haitians during his campaign, which was
during his first term.
It was very, very terrible things to say about people. So I don't know if it's like you want to lower people's status so you don't feel so bad about hurting them. I don't get it. I just don't understand the whole program when they are doing exactly what they're asking people to do. I don't get it. So I guess my hope is right now is that it ends up in court and that there's some they stall this process until they can sort it out. I mean, because it's not only Haiti. You've talked about Ukraine and Nicaragua and Venezuela and Cuba. Very difficult situations you're sending those people back to.
And these people weren't here permanently to begin with. They were here temporarily. They were able to work, and then they were able to seek pathways to permanent citizenship.
Correct. And so they were given, I believe it was a 2-year work visa.
Yeah.
But they were also able then to have conversations with the immigration office about extending that or going back or whatever. It was a 2-year work visa that they were allowed. So it wasn't a permanent thing, but it was for people to come in and fill jobs and work. And so I guess the other way you could look at it, like you want to deport 500,000 people, but the other side of that is we also have 500,000 workers here that are filling jobs and paying taxes and becoming great citizens and what we want people to do. And I hope some of them have the opportunity to stay. And I hope some of them decide if they want to go back and help their country, that's a great thing too. But that choice seems to be taken away from them.
Have you had any response from Department of Homeland Security or our congressional delegation?
I did reach out to our congressional delegation. I did not receive any response from two offices, and I got a very kind of, I would say, pat answer, form letter kind of response from one other office about immigration. Nothing specific. And I know their offices are being inundated with lots of concerns right now, but I've not heard anything back.
That's Bruce Bloomer, co-founder of the Haiti Alive nonprofit. Now, again, a judge has temporarily blocked the Trump administration's attempts this week. The administration wants to revoke the legal status of some Haitians, Cubans, Nicaraguans, Venezuelans, and Ukrainians. Now, we reached out to Representative Dusty Johnson's office, and we asked where Haitians who are losing their visas would go, especially since the Federal Aviation Administration is no longer offering flights to Port-au-Prince in Haiti due to safety concerns. We received a response from Congressman Johnson's office telling us they have not received further guidance or clarity from the Department of Homeland Security at this time. We reached out to DHS and ICE for further clarification. Neither organization has responded to our inquiries. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. You may have seen South Dakota Senator John Thune's name in national news headlines. That comes as Thune is facing heightened scrutiny now he is majority leader of the U.S. Senate. Organizations like The New Yorker and AP News are paying close attention to Thune's actions and leadership style, especially how he is working with the White House. No one knows U.S. Senator John Thune better than the folks in South Dakota, so we asked our Dakota political junkies for analysis from a local perspective. John Hunter is publisher emeritus of the Madison Daily Leader. He's a member of the South Dakota Newspaper Hall of Fame. Dr. Michael Card is professor emeritus of political science at the University of South Dakota. They joined me in SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. No surprise, U.S. Senator John Thune from South Dakota is getting a lot of press lately. There was an extensive profile on him in The New Yorker on March 31st by David Kirkpatrick. I was also interested in an AP story by Stephen Groves talking about him and his approach. Obviously, Stephen Groves reported in South Dakota before in the state capitol. So there are a lot of people with eyes on Thune. Why? Anything interesting happening in Congress that's worth watching right now? Everybody seems to be asking the same question, and maybe a political scientist is the best place to start, about the separation of powers and what Congress's role is with a president who is determined, as probably all presidents arguably are, but this one in some new ways, to gather power and use it and leverage it as quickly as possible.
Right. And we, since Franklin Roosevelt, we have had an obsession with the first 100 days of a new president's term. There is a uniqueness here that we haven't seen a lot since the New Deal days, and that is that the Republican Party has a trifecta. They have the president, they have a majority control in each of the chambers of the legislature or the Congress in this case. I think the other part is a new president, when there is a legislature or a Congress of the same party, they work very hard to get those nominees approved. Yeah. And they may not be giving them the full examination, but yeah, they leave that up to the opposition party to raise the questions. And since they only need a simple majority to be approved, it looks like what Senator Thune or Majority Leader Thune, that's his role here as, more so than as a senator, he left the questioning up to the committees. Yeah. And in that sense, he was able to remain free, but still to guide the process along and give general parameters as to how they were going to do this. And they've just slowly marched ahead and confirmed all that remained nominated.
And I had kind of almost forgotten this idea, John, that there might be a recess appointment because Leader Thune said, you know, we're going to do this the old-fashioned way. We're going to stay here all night until these people are confirmed. We're on your side, Mr. President. That is not insignificant that that is how they did, because we're going to talk in a minute here about all the other things that are happening with this administration that Congress can or cannot address. But this was an important early look into how Leader Thune was going to run the Senate.
True. And I think John Thune is a good person for this position. He has demonstrated thoughtfulness throughout his congressional career. Remember that he has slowly evolved into this position. Remember, you kind of move up the ladder at least a little bit. And so he was a whip for a while and then assistant leader and so forth. So he understands it as well as anyone. He has been willing to challenge the president, I would say, in private. A couple of times we've seen some public statements on behalf of him, but I think when you talk to him, I think you get an honest feel of who he is and what he's doing. I think he's realizes that the separation of power has changed, or at the shift of power has changed. I would guess that John would be very frustrated with that, the fact that the president can merely issue executive orders and ignore Congress altogether. I would guess that internally that's very frustrating to him. He also, I think, realizes perhaps that Congress abdicated some of that by not being able to get anything passed on their own. And so for the longest time, especially if you have, you know, the filibuster thing in the Senate, and the fact if you ever have split houses by parties, they can't seem to get anything done. So they kind of handed the power to the presidency and the courts. And now you have a shift where if the president is going to ignore the courts that gives a whole new thing. Then we're heading toward some sort of totalitarianism. If you ignore Congress and the courts order you to do something, you say, forget it, I'm not going to. That's a whole new realm that we haven't seen. It wasn't the FDR thing. FDR pulled people, pulled Congress along, maybe strong-armed them. He did certainly have appointments to the Supreme Court that helped favor him. But that was a completely different situation. And remember, he was fighting both the Depression and later World War II, whereas it wasn't necessarily in for his own particular satisfaction or for his own gain.
Mike, but we don't know how much of this will shake out. The Trump administration is ignoring Congress on certain things, money that has been appropriated, saying that can no longer be spent, that department's being shut down. We are not going to comply with this federal judge's order because we don't think a federal judge can provide a check on a president. That's the Supreme Court that does that. So we're going to go through an appeals process. A lot of this takes time to sort of play out. Meanwhile, people's lives are upended.
Very much so. And I think the thing that we have to remember as a basis for considering any of this is that our founders considered the separation of powers to be the ultimate protection of personal liberties, so that they would check each other and not form a totalitarian regime, or that the Supreme Court couldn't run amok with their own judgments, and nor could the Congress. Mm. And so each was to have mechanisms to check the power of the other and the authority of the other, because they separated out the authority. We've also done that in our state. If it's Article 2 mm-hmm. in the South Dakota Constitution, it certainly was the basis of how to keep a republic operating without falling into tyranny. I'm getting a little nerdy on this, but
please.
The rationale for a republic was to have it be before the emperors in the Roman system. That is that you elected representatives. They were elites, no doubt, but we're seeing that to some extent, the elites are becoming senators and representatives. It's not mm-hmm. a citizen legislature like South Dakota has.
Sure.
But the republic failed when the emperors became emperors,
okay.
when the consuls became emperors. You know, there were two consuls who were meant to check each other's power. They had to deal with the Senate. And so when that ends, that's when the republic ends. And I think that's what political scientists have as a fear of what seems to be the direction we're heading.
So far, you don't see much pushback from Congress because those are Republican majorities. They may vocalize some things, but by and large, they are falling in line. I'm curious if in 19 months from now, if Congress changes, which I think it's likely to do, if they will be equally ignored and just say, forget it, Congress doesn't matter, even if Congress takes a vote. You know, we have a situation where Congress has passed certain federal laws and the president is telling the Justice Department, don't pursue that. Don't prosecute these white-collar crimes and don't prosecute those people, telling people essentially you can break the law that Congress passed and a previous president would have signed because I declare that. So.
Yeah.
I'm just kind of curious how this happens when there isn't the at least tacit support by both chambers of Congress.
Yeah. All right. So they have been consumed with confirmations in some ways, and there has not been a lot of legislation that's come out of Congress. Also, they're very careful about what they being pretty much every Republican member of the Senate and the House, is cautious about what they say publicly, because this is a president who's very sensitive to anything that, you know, might be said about him publicly, and he's probably going to know about it. But what's Senator Thune's job right now, beyond the confirmation hearings?
I think it's a very hard job, really, to corral all the members of your own party with a fairly thin majority and to get them to pass these kinds of things. And again, I think John's a great person for this. He tends to build consensus. He tends to get along with people, even though they may disagree on particular issues. I think he's very skilled at that. And so that's really the first part. Building that bridge to the White House is the second part, and that's where he has to balance this thing. And I remember pretty clearly when Tom Daschle became leader when President Clinton was in, is that Tom really had to change a little bit of how he acted in Congress. He really needed to now carry the water for President Clinton. Mm-hmm. And so, and that's in South Dakotans. I don't think this is going to happen to John, but South Dakotans tend to lose people a little bit when they start acting to Washington, or they, you know, they don't. I think Tom still came back and visited 66 counties a year, but I think some of them he had to drive through fast when he was a leader. Again, I think corralling your group and his responsibility is being the leader of this Republicans in the Senate and then building the bridge to the White House. There's probably a bridge also that I'm less aware of to the House and to the Republicans in the House. And I don't know how that relation. I frankly don't know.
What would you add to that?
That's a little more challenging because the House wants to reduce the deficit much more than the Senate does. But part of that's because the Senate has to represent the whole state. The rural areas of the country are beneficiaries of Medicare and Social Security. They're growing older faster, if you'll accept that as a metaphor, because the younger people are leaving, so the whole state is getting older. And the Senate is not at all into eliminating, you know, that $880 billion cut that basically is going to have to come out of Medicare and Medicaid that the House passed. So what they've done is they've basically passed separate bills but said, we'll work it out. It's just passing the buck down, kicking the can down the road, passing the buck a little bit. But when they come back from this Easter Passover recess, they will have real challenges, and it will be a real challenge for Senator Majority Leader Thune to get a bill through the Senate that will also get through the House in terms of allocating funds.
Yeah.
And so what they've decided to do with the Senate generally wanting tax cuts is they are calling the continuation of the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act to be a continuing appropriation, so it's not a new tax. Now, in South Dakota, I'm fairly confident that our Supreme Court would say no, but Congress may not have that challenge because who has standing to sue?
All right, so I want to go back because you mentioned Tom Daschle, and so I was looking up today in preparation for our time together, sort of what were some of the things that define Tom Daschle's time as leader. And, of course, Mitch McConnell, looking up some of the things that, you know, people think of his legacy of, you know, cementing the makeup of the current Supreme Court. And one of the things I saw in Daschle's, a quotation from him was that he blamed the Bush tax cuts for the disappearance of the budget surplus. And I thought, budget surplus? Like, was there a time that we had a budget? So what are we talking
about?
Believe
it or not, there was.
There
and
was.
So my point to that is how many Americans, I am not a young person, and that, I mean, I was an adult during that time, and I had forgotten. For younger people, people younger than us, they might never remember a time when Congress really legislated. That might be like the golden era of Congress. They're used to a president coming in and really saying, this is a, you know, what happens in the White House is really matters more than who you send to Congress. Are we forgetting what Congress is supposed to do is what I'm wondering.
Well, I think to a degree, yes, if you don't mind me speaking first here. Here's an interesting thing about that particular time. It was really the dot-com bubble that helped cause this. And so the valuation of these dot-coms went way up, and people sold them, had made all sorts of. So it was the receipts side, the income side that made it a surplus. It wasn't that we were reasonable about spending. So
noted.
Now, here's another thing. If I may get personal for a quick second. So this is just a story I hope is okay. It was right during that time I wrote an editorial, the Madison Day Leader, and said, hey, look, let's take this surplus, and boy, it's tempting. Everyone wants to spend it. Those were the days when you had congressional earmarks. I'm going to give it to every person so I can get reelected. I said, let's leave that temptation back. This is the editorial, and use it to pay down some of the long-term debt. I said the 30-year bond especially would be a great thing. So anyway, a few weeks go by, and I get a call from Senator Daschle's staff and said, Senator Daschle would like to meet with you on Saturday, whatever it was. And I said, really? No kidding. He said, find a restaurant where you can have lunch with. And it was on a Saturday, though, so it wasn't a weekday. So And then a staffer called the day before and said, did you get anything by FedEx today? And I said, no. I didn't think so. Like, oh, he starts to scramble. So next day we met at the restaurant next door to the newspaper. I brought Mary and the kids. And Senator Daschle came and he presented me with a framed print of the congressional record in which he had submitted my editorial.
Oh.
So the congressional record, he said, and, you know, he stood up on the Senate and said, I would like to submit to the congressional record this editorial by a newspaper in our home state. And it listed that editorial about not doing it. It also included, I think, there were two editorials, one from Dana Hess, who you also know, and now with South Dakota Searchlight, but at the time editor of the Peer Capital Journal. And he had something similar to that. But it was, I thought it was a really nice gesture to give this big frame print of the congressional record. So, and then we talked about it at lunch, of course. But he was rock solid on that, on paying off the debt with the surplus and not blowing it. And that's not really what happened.
Yeah,
I do remember at about the same time, Madison received an appropriation that was an earmark from Senator Johnson at the time to build some building in
Tim Madison. Johnson, yeah.
Tim Johnson, yeah, yes. Uh-huh. So anyway, forgive me for bringing in that story.
America, if you had listened to John Hunter, today's conversation would have been a lot different.
Didn't you bring up my editorial where I misguessed the...
You don't have to remind people of that. This cancels that out.
No,
yeah.
I'm going to send a link to everybody.
Also, Leader Thune, we are available for lunch. If you'd like, you don't need to frame anything for us.
We'll pay for lunch even.
We'll treat you for lunch. Go ahead, Mike.
That was a very different time in the sense that we were concerned about budget deficits and spending, and then 9/11 happened.
Yeah.
And we took the war from Iraq off of our budget considerations, except we just were going to spend money. It wasn't considered part of the operating budget.
And the bipartisanship of Tom Daschle and Trent Lott became toxic.
Yes.
And now we have this vast separation of how difficult it is. They were sneaking behind the lines to go visit each other because if they were photographed together, they would both be seen as selling out.
I agree, Lori. That I think you phrased it correctly. That was an inflection point where the leaders didn't. Now, turns out that they did meet a lot during that time, and they had a good relationship, and they did admit, they both have admitted they undermined each other at times, but but it was a different
that
relationship.
That brings up that the media landscape is different because who are they hiding from? They're not hiding.
Right.
That's too strong of a word. But the press and social media and how quickly information goes out. Oh, they're working together.
Well, as a non-journalist here, I can say most of us believe that if it bleeds, it leads. And so you need conflict and controversy in order to get people to read a story. Now, that's a non-journalist perspective, and you're both looking at me as if I have two heads.
That's not how I think at all.
We put headlines in the paper. Congress did another good job today. That's the headline.
I'm kind of outside the it bleeds, it leads world of journalism. Okay, so I went back to Senator Thune. Rescission is something else. We talk about the courts, and this New Yorker article, I think, which is about it's called The Senate's Age of Irrelevance. A whole lot of people have shared it. You really should read it all the way through. It's just really good journalism, for starters.
Mm-hmm.
A certain amount of things need to be sorted out in the courts. That's painful and difficult and remains to be seen, and probably we need to have Mike Thompson come in and explain to us exactly how this works. But I want to talk about this budget-cutting thing. If Congress has appropriated some money and then Doge and Elon Musk and the president say, no, that's not going to get spent there, there is this way that they can try to get through Congress through the process of rescission, which I had no idea existed. But then you have to get the votes.
In law, in statute, there is the Congressional Impoundment Act. It was used, built support in the Republican Party for something like that through Lyndon Johnson. But it was basically Richard Nixon wanting to control spending again, wanting to control and put money towards policies that he was in favor of and activities, and basically said, I'm not going to spend this money.
Mm-hmm.
And Congress has standing to sue, and the Supreme Court ruled, nope, if Congress appropriates it, you have to spend it. That part is exceptionally clear and has been stood up a number of times when it's been challenged. The rescission part is really getting acquiescence from Congress that, okay, we're not going to spend this. And that can be done in the form of resolutions. But the specific details, I'm sorry, I can't march us through that.
You know
that.
Who can march us through that? Leader John Thune, because according to this article, he explained it to Donald Trump, the President of the United States. Which brings me to my point of this is a person who needs to understand how government works so well that he can play all the cards at all the right times. Right. Is he up for that task?
Absolutely. I believe that he is up to that task. He understands this well. He has, I think, all the characteristics it would take to do this. Now, whether it's enjoyable for him or not, I don't know. You know, there have been times when he thinks, like, should I run, you know, should I run again? Because this, because Congress has changed while he was there. But I think he's very, very capable of doing that and could be the best person that I can think of who could be in that job.
John Hunter is Publisher Emeritus of the Madison Daily Leader. Mike Card is Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of South Dakota. You can find this conversation and more political analysis at our Dakota Political Junkies podcast. Listen on your favorite podcast platform. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. On your next conference call, ask yourself, are you sure the other faces on the screen belong to human beings? Real-time artificial intelligence deepfakes can be convincing on video conferences, so convincing that a group of Dakota State University students recently presented on the topic to congressional leadership and their staff. Two of those students, Ethan Price and Joe Hammond, joined me via Zoom. Don't worry, we screened them, they're people. Let's begin here with Ethan Price.
So I'm currently finishing my final year at Dakota State University for finishing my master's in computer science. And this year, Dakota State University offered a new type of opportunity for students. And it was originally called AI Bagel Time. It has now changed names since then to be a little bit more professional, where companies come in and they offer real world problems that their businesses are facing. And so SBS, cybersecurity here in Madison, was one of these companies that came in, and they basically presented a bunch of different problems for us to tackle. And one of them that really piqued our interest was this one on building a training module to bring to companies and businesses to see how deepfakes can affect them in real time. Me, Joe, and then Samyam, Nick, and we built essentially a real life application where you could deepfake anybody in real time, and then via a virtual camera could upload that video stream, this deepfake video stream, into any video conferencing software. So Zoom, Teams, Google Meet. So now these kind of platforms where we think that, you know, it's more secure because we can see your face, we can see you talking in real time, aren't as secure anymore, and that people just need to be watching out for this next level of security threats.
Yeah. Joe, tell me a little bit about how, quote unquote, easy it was, in the sense that did you have to spend a lot of money or find some random AI tool that nobody else knows about, or were the tools pretty much just waiting to be exploited in that way?
I mean, in terms of cost, it's really not that hard. I mean, I think we're looking at maybe $10 to $20 an hour in terms of like overall cost, which is nothing compared to, like, let's say you're doing like a spear phishing attack and you're doing a CEO. I mean, if you get financial access to that company, $10 to $20 an hour is a drop in the bucket. The tooling was very easy to access, surprisingly. We first reached out and looked into all the open source community and found that there was a lot of developed programs that were ready to be used. And these aren't state of the art, but they were good enough to be adopted and put in use and molded to our uses.
Ethan, for people who don't quite understand what a deep fake is, think of explaining it to your grandmother for a minute and how it might show up in her life.
Yeah. A deepfake is any type of media that has been altered or generated via typically AI or machine learning tactics. Okay. So for example, these can fall into video streams. So like if you're FaceTiming your grandson, if we're using this grandmother example, your grandson could be look like Jennifer Lawrence, or it could look like any sort of person, but it will still be him underneath it, just pretending or looking like a different celebrity person or figure in their lives. that's the main idea. So deepfakes can come in videos, photos, voice cloning, things like that. But they're typically used for malicious reasons, to try to scam people out of money, to like exploit those who might not be educated in this sense.
Yeah. So in other words, if your grandson FaceTimes you and says, send me money, I'm in the hospital or I'm in jail, that could be pretend.
Yes, that might not be your grandson.
That might not be your grandson. So that's a typical scam played out on elderly people is your grandchild calls, they're in trouble, we need money right now, and the grandparent is very nervous about it. So that's why I'm bringing it to that grandparent level.
Yeah,
because
for
it's
sure.
a common thing. But Joe, you mentioned a CEO, you know, give me access to something. Give us an idea of a broader scam that somehow this could take place in real time as we speak, really.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's telling that the company that we first started this with was a cybersecurity company for banks because they were looking to protect their institutions. So we can imagine a scenario where we have a CEO from a bank and we have a bad actor who wants to get control of the bank's finances. One thing that might typically happen is that banks often wire money. Sometimes they do this informally via like call. So your CFO of the bank might call the CEO and they're on the say and they're like, oh, we need to move X amount of money here. And then he calls up this person. He's like, I need to transfer this money from here to here, right? Well, what if this person wasn't your CFO? And what, you know what I mean? Like there's scenarios where you can put yourself in the loop or impersonate people. Mm-hmm. And that'll give you privileged access to things that you might not otherwise have.
So you take this research to Washington, to the U.S. Capitol. Do I understand that correctly? Ethan, tell me a little bit about, you're in the room with some pretty heavy-hitting colleges there at Dakota State, introducing yourself from South Dakota, from the Midwest. Tell me that story.
Yeah, so we were, one of our supervisor for this project, Dr. Mark Spanier here at Dakota State University, was reached out by a nonprofit organization called CAPE, the Center of AI Policy, and they were looking for these AI safety teams to present to congressional leaders and staffers in DC. And so we apply, we put our proposal together, we got accepted, and then we were heading off to DC. But beforehand, we had an orientation, and there was this kind of sudden moment where we realized how big of an event this was, because we were introducing schools and the topics that they were going to present on, and they started off with, you know, our team from Harvard, our team from MIT, Brown, Duke, Notre Dame, all of these very prestigious institutions, and then little old Dakota State University.
Is a player on that national scene. Joe, they were pretty interested in your research. What were some of the comments or questions you got?
We got a lot of questions about feasibility, like how can we do this? How are bad people, bad actors using this? We got a lot of questions about price, like you said, like how could your average everyday Joe eventually figure this out and use it for themselves, right? We also got asked, like, how good it is. Like, because some people walked up and they were like, well, it's all right, but I've seen better. And we're like, we had to stress that. We're using, you know, open technology that we took from the internet and put into use, and that there are better models out there that are more state of the art.
I'm going to just jump in here and let people know we're talking with Ethan Price and Joe Hammond here on In the Moment. Two students from Dakota State University about AI deep fakes and really how easy it is to perpetuate them or perpetrate crimes using them, I guess the right word would be. Ethan, some basic things that people need to be aware about now, beyond what we've already talked about, and some safety measures that you could start putting into place today to prevent falling victim to one of these deep fake scams.
So it might sound silly, but code words or keywords that you know your family uses quite often, or, you know, just starting off with like, hey, you know, what's your favorite color? And if it's like chartreuse, then you know, like they're good, right? Or just like something simple like that, that you might always have in place. It sounds silly, but like, it's probably one of the most sure ways to prevent any of these attacks. And then it's just not always believing what you see on video, on streams, always being cautious, having that little birdie in the back of your mind, letting you know if something seems off, okay? Really watch these videos too, because as Joe said, we were using very old models, not state of the art, but they worked extremely well. They were blurry, they were pixelated, just like how we are right now on Zoom. And so watching how they move their heads, if like some of this face matching technology is not fully lining up, seeing if there's like weird video discrepancies, and just always being vigilant on who you're talking to and if this is a high security. Although it probably won't happen to your grandmother because these are very long, drawn out kind of attacks, these deepfake ones, it's still important to always be vigilant on any cybersecurity issue. So not always believing those texts that you're getting, not always believing the call that you're hearing.
Yeah. And Joe, if you're in business, you should be talking to the person who's doing your cybersecurity. I mean, you should have a cybersecurity plan already.
Yes.
I'm guessing every bank does, for example. But these are questions you should be asking that team.
And just to piggyback off Ethan, yeah. I think a really good method to keep yourself safe, if you do believe there's some kind of attack going on or you're really skeptical about a call, I would say just use something like out-of-band communication. So text them afterwards, maybe find another platform to message them on. And if they confirm everything, everything's good, right? But it's a really good way to defuse some of these attacks because usually the attacker only has access to one communication vector.
Yeah. As a journalist, I think a lot of journalists are wondering, you know, when is the first time that I'm going to be doing an interview with someone and it turns out they're not a real person? You know, we do so many interviews remotely. So how good is it with back and forth, random questions, that sorts of things? How conversational can these deepfakes be?
Very conversational. I think many people would be surprised. It's real time. They can answer your questions. Mouths are moving, your facial expressions, emotions. It's very surprising once you first see like a really good model deployed. And some of these models only need like one image to 10 seconds of video and you're cloned.
Jeez, it's a little unnerving. So let's talk ethics. Ethan, you're in grad school there, and Joe, you're in undergrad. And I'm curious what kind of training both of you are having about the ethics of AI, because you've got a lot of tools in your hands, and I'm thinking that you're probably thinking about the best way to use them. Ethan, you start with that, please.
Yeah, so I'm actually in a class right now called Professional Application Ethics of AI, where we kind of discuss all of these things. What does it mean to be intelligent? What does it mean to be smart? How do we securely and safely get data and collect data with being aware of the privacy of our consumers? Just because we have these AI systems doesn't necessarily mean we can build an AI system, or should we build an AI system? I mean, not everyone can just build an atomic bomb, right? Not everyone should be allowed to just build these crazy, powerful, strong AI systems. And there probably should be some regulation as to how far these can go. I mean, I'm pretty sure it was 2 months ago, February, there was a policy just put in place through the Congress that was now kind of restricting and making these deepfake attacks illegal. So you couldn't use them in a malicious way. A really, really huge problem with the deepfakes right now is like using it for pornographic reasons and basically attacking children or other students, where they could just put it on these kind of sexually explicit content and then just put it out there for everyone to see, even though it's not real. So there are laws being passed now that are kind of putting restrictions on this type of technology, which I think is great.
Yeah. Joe, in the undergrad world, how are they helping you begin to think in new ways about the ethics of what you're studying?
In the undergrad world, we're learning a lot about bias and data, and how when you train these models, that there can be a lot of different biases that come into effect and will influence how the model, you know, results. So you might get certain bias that gives you a result that might, you know, disproportionately affect a population of a certain race or maybe a certain gender or health group. You know what I mean? And these are the type of things you have to look out for, because in the real world, the data is messy. And so it takes a lot of effort to clean and make sure that you aren't misrepresenting certain groups.
Two students from Dakota State University, Ethan Price and Joe Hammond, they're recapping their AI deepfake presentation on Capitol Hill in Washington. And that is our show for today. We hope that it served you. In the Moment is produced by Ellen Kester and Ari Youngeman. I'm Lori Walsh from all of us here at SDPB. Thank you for listening.